This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, I should say host, but also realtors with Oakland Realty in downtown Vancouver. So excited for our guest today. We've got Brendan Lacerda. He's an associate director and senior economist with Moody's Analytics. And Brendan, of course, serves as the lead analyst for the Canadian Economic Forecast.
It's always great having Brendan on the show. He is an outsider. He's an American. He lives in Philadelphia. But he is the go-to for the smart money from around the world who engage Moody's to find out what the future of the Canadian economy looks like. And for that, we are eternally grateful that he makes time to sit down with us. And this conversation doesn't disappoint. We're talking Trump tariffs. We're talking the Canadian economy. We're talking real estate, BC economy. It runs a gamut. And everyone's going to leave feeling a little smarter.
Yeah, the tariffs thing. We're getting a lot of questions about the tariffs and there's not a lot of answers about these tariffs. So we'll see. But this is something that is on our radar that we're watching. Before we get to our conversation with Brendan, Matt, of course, we've got a new segment sponsored by Scalina Real Estate, which is our real estate team, about trivia, Vancouver and Vancouver real estate. I think you got a question this week.
We're workshopping some titles, the property pop quiz. You discarded that one immediately.
Definitely not that one.
The question this week is a tricky one, but we'll see how you do. In 1862, Adam, three Englishmen, and they were known as the Three Greenhorns, okay? They purchased 550 acres of land in what is now Vancouver's West End. And what I'm thinking is, was this back when the terminus was New West? Because this could have been center ice, or it could have been out in the boonies. I don't know. The question for you, Adam, is 550 acres, 1862, how much did the Greenhorns pay?
I'm going to go $100 an acre. So what is that? 55 grand.
Well, I'd like to say you're close, Adam. They paid $550 and 75 cents. So that's just slightly over a dollar an acre is what they tied up 550 acres of land in the West End back in 1862. Yeah, you got to keep in mind, this was almost 150 years ago.
Wow. And that just goes to show inflation. I feel like I could drop that pretty quick at the pump, Jack.
I'm thinking about where I go in the West End.
You know what? I love the West End. I just haven't been to many, but I'm guessing, you know, I mean, that's not much money.
Okay. The point is taken. Let's move on to our featured listing this week. The listing that we are highlighting, it's coming out. It's hitting MLS on Monday. It is 495 West 29th. This is a townhome in the complex from 2019 Park Elise. I think everybody will be familiar with this building. The beautiful building at the corner of 29th and Cambie, right on the corner across the street, I should say, from Queen Elizabeth Park. This property is a townhome in the complex, so you have access to the amenities, but you have your own front door. You're actually facing into Queen Elizabeth Park. Two bed, three bath, 1,128 square feet, offered for $1.329. And like I said, that's going to hit MLS and Vancouver Real Estate Podcast on Monday. So watch for that. It's a phenomenal townhome. And while you're there at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com, Adam, you're going to want to click sell with us, because when you do that, you have access to the most downloaded document of all time that we've created, the Sold Plan. Tell us about the Sold Plan, Adam.
Yeah, Matt, while you're there, definitely check out the Sold Plan. This is our step-by-step guide for getting top dollar for your home in the shortest amount of time. And of course, it is available for free. It's an instant download. Just click sell with us and you can download the Sold Plan today. And without further ado, let's cut to our conversation with Brendan Lacerda.
Enjoy.
This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly four decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it is also making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
Adam, we want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects. Soane House, one of Marcon's latest communities that features a West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced, Nordic-inspired design for architecture that endures.
Soane House offers 165 junior one to three-bedroom homes in West Coquitlam, integrating nature into the built environment.
Register today at marcon.ca/soanehouse. That's marcon.ca/soenhaus, or visit the display center at Outpost in Port Moody.
We also want to highlight 102 and Park. With billions already invested in Surrey City's central development over the last 15 years, the time is now to invest in its future, Surrey 3.0.
Introducing 102 and Park, a simple, straightforward skyscraper featuring 376 homes. Quite simply, this is a once-in-a-decade opportunity coming soon to Surrey's central downtown plaza. This is a time and the place to invest. Register at marcon.ca/102andpark. That's marcon.ca/102andpark.
Marcon, building for life. Okay, so we're here with Brendan Lacerda. He is director in the Economic Research Group at Moody's Analytics and lead analyst for the Canadian Economic Forecast and a member of the Global Model Development Team at Moody's. How you doing, Brendan?
I'm doing well. As you can see, you know, they're keeping me busy.
Yeah, that's an understatement. You are also a multiple time past guest and, of course, fan favorite. But for those listening who haven't heard you on the show before, Brendan, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me back, by the way. Really appreciate it. As you said, I work in our economic research group, but primarily what we do is economic forecasting. And really, our bread and butter is sort of alternative macroeconomic scenario forecasting. So I work closely with banks, insurers, other financial institutions to help them prepare for possible macroeconomic shocks. We do a lot of sort of scenario analysis around sort of like, what if, you know, how high would the unemployment rate go, you know, if Trump imposes a tariff? Because you think for banks and insurers, you know, that has an impact on their bottom line. You know, what does it mean for whether or not, you know, their borrowers are going to pay back loans or not?
Or just to, and this wasn't part of the program as I had envisioned it, but just thinking out loud here, when you talk about insurers, are you modeling out kind of climate change related scenarios? Are you like, I'm just thinking, of course, the LA fires that were, I'm not even sure if they're not out, I don't think at this point, but like, do you look at that at all in terms of how that impacts the economy in terms of rising costs in the real estate sector?
Absolutely. That is a large and emerging risk. We've recently expanded the type of scenarios that we produce to include different types of climate change scenarios. So you can imagine, I think, you know, what you're talking about, the physical risks, you know, what are the impacts of wildfires, droughts, hurricanes, things of that sort. On the flip side too, you know, what are the macroeconomic costs of trying to mitigate that through, you know, carbon taxes or things of that sort. So we sort of model that trade-off between, you know, sort of handling the transition risks associated with climate change and the physical risks and dangers that climate change poses. Yeah, that is a growing concern, as you mentioned, for banks, insurers, you know, the financial system globally. So yeah, something we're spending a lot of time studying these days.
What in this is, again, just totally just thinking out loud. What's your take on you know, like we brought you back because we always love to check in with you. Of course, this will go out actually a week after Trump's inauguration, which actually happened yesterday to timestamp it. But I see one of his, I don't have it in front of me, but some of the initial changes to government seem to be uninterested in climate change policy or climate change mitigation. Do you see that as just an 100% negative, or is it more that, you know, deregulation is potentially going to help in some way? Am I way out to left field on this question? Because I'm just interested in, like,
hey, isn't thinking, this a real estate podcast? Yeah, what are you talking about here?
I'm just thinking through those initial changes that we saw yesterday, or trying to.
I would say this, you know, it's when you look at his policy agenda, it's focused on a lot of other things that aren't climate change. But he may not really have the ultimate decision over whether or not it's an important issue, because, you know, from our perspective, it is going to be very important, because the stability of homeowner insurance markets across the country is under threat. You have a serious issue with insurers dropping coverage. You know, then you run into the whole problem, you know, homeowners being uninsured, you know, what happens to the mortgages in this case? So as much as, you know, maybe they would prefer to, you know, not deal with the issue and, you know, it's not important to them, I think with, you know, what we saw in LA and what we've also been seeing going on down in like Florida and the southern United States, there are problems developing in financial markets and financial institutions that policymakers will have to address. Because, you know, in essence, these insurance markets are collapsing.
And so maybe, and I was just thinking what it was, and it was the Paris Climate Accord, I think he withdrew
That's
from.
Right.
But of course, so taking a different stance, but it's still going to be an issue that they have to, they can't escape by the sounds of it, which is terrifying.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess not to always be, you know, so Debbie Downer, you know, pessimistic about this. I mean, if you look at the data there's a lot of encouraging developments going on with climate change. I mean, we're seeing, you know, I can speak for like the United States and Canada, you know, per capita CO2 emissions have been going down over the last few years. We're seeing a lot of new technologies emerge around, you know, batteries and EV vehicles, which look like they're going to do a lot to help address, you know, carbon emissions. So I think at least what we're seeing with, I think on the technology side of things, there's a lot to be optimistic about with regard to climate change. But as you said, you know, at least on the policy front, when you see the United States pulling back from, you know, the Paris Agreement, you know, that's not very encouraging.
Maybe switching gears a little bit, Brendan, how's Canada's economy doing? I think I might know the answer to this, but go ahead.
I mean, what's the benchmark for comparison? Yeah.
How does it feel like it's doing?
How does it feel like it's doing? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for all the doom and gloom, you know, Canada's not in recession. You know, the economy continues to grow, albeit slowly. I think though, but, you know, by point of comparison, comparing it to the United States, which is, you know, really just been gangbusters over the last, you know, 2-3 years, growing really strongly. I can see, you know, when you sort of hold those two economies up, you know, Canada starts to look not so bright. Yeah. So, you know, from the professional economist perspective, you know, from our view, like, you know, 2% GDP growth, that's kind of the benchmark between like good and bad. Canada's been below that mark over the last, you know, year, 2 years. But then when you couple in like the demographic factors, you know, you would have expected the economy to grow a lot more, a lot, you know, stronger. So yeah, you know, all in all, you know, not a ton to be optimistic about, but, you know, it's not as bad as, you know, maybe the haters make it out to be.
Wait, what in your mind are some of the bright spots economy-wise in Canada right now? And I'm thinking either regions or industries or something that we're not maybe aware of from where we're sitting?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you wind back the clock, you know, go back a year ago, you know, what are we really nervous about? I think the mortgage rate renewal shock was top of mind. You know, how are households going to handle this swell in their debt service costs? You know, are they going to have to deleverage? You know, what's going to happen on that front? And I think households have handled that, you know, more gracefully than expected. It's gone better than expected. So we've seen households lift their savings rate. So people are repairing their balance sheets. People are getting their finances in better shape. as a result of this, you know, shock from higher interest rates. We've, you know, it's, I know that there's been a lot of press attention on how Canada has sort of negative productivity, that productivity's contracted, you know, over the last few years. And to the extent that you would care about that, you care about it because it impacts wage growth. But if you actually look at the wage growth numbers, they've been pretty strong. They've been up, you know, 4 or 5% like year over year. So that means households are getting, you know, real wage gains, which is a plus for the economy, a plus for like the housing market too. So I think sometimes we rush to, you know, maybe focus on sort of the next, you know, shock or the next risk of, you know, what's going to pop up. But looking back at a risk which was really top of our minds a year ago and seeing how it has resolved, you know, better than expected. And now we have, you know, households heading into 2025 with, you know, a lot of spending power, with, you know, an elevated savings rate, you know, with curtailing, you know, credit over the last year. Prior to the election, you know, our view was it looks like things are going in the right direction. You know, the economy will start to accelerate as the year goes on, you know, as interest rates start to come in. Unfortunately, you know, the outlook has gotten a little scrambled with what we expect the changes to be on U.S. policy. But, you know, a lot of uncertainty is exactly around what happens with U.S. policy over the next year.
So it sounds like, and before we kind of get to the U.S. policy, so decent wage gains. I feel like that you're right. Like all we were talking about was, you know, the massive amounts of debt that the individual Canadian had. So we're getting that under control, which is great. What in your mind should we be nervous about? What in Canada, if you had to point to some not so optimistic points about our economy right now, what would you point to?
I mean, it does go back to trade. And I know that we're probably going to have a big discussion around that today. But I was traveling around Ottawa and Toronto, actually back in like October, like right before the election, and talking with a lot of, you know, policymakers in the federal government. And I kept hearing that, you know, oh yeah, you know, Trump is threatening these tariffs, but, you know, the United States and Canada, you know, we have like a special relationship where we're an ally, and, you know, maybe that to some degree, you know, exempts us from, you know, these potential taxes. And I was kind of trying to reiterate now, I was trying to make the point, no, I wouldn't take comfort in the, you know, historical alliance between our two countries, because I just don't know if that applies in this situation. You know, I was trying to make the argument to folks that if you listen to Trump's remarks, he is fixated on the US's trade deficit. And, you know, I had a lot of Canadians telling me, okay, yeah, you know, Canada has this big surplus with the United States, but most of that's energy and oil. So if you take that out, you know, our trade balance is actually, you know, fairly even. And, you know, he would never put a tariff on oil or anything like that. And I kept going back to, you know, no, you know, if you look at the US's, you know, what the US is importing and who it's importing it from, you know, number one is Mexico, China, and then Canada's number three. And if you add up those three countries, that's like 40% or a little more of US imports. So, you know, Trump clearly has a more mercantilist view about the US trade account, which means that he views the United States trade deficit as kind of like a profit loss statement, that, you know, the United States is losing money. And, you know, in his argument, we must be getting like ripped off by, you know, other countries. So regardless of, you know, what relationship or alliances we previously had, his goal is to reduce the US trade deficit. And, you know, sort of that means Canada is in the crosshairs. And there's no way to reduce that trade deficit without putting tariffs on, you know, Mexico, China, and Canada. And so I think, you know, at least I was talking to policymakers, you know, Canada should prepare, you know, should assign a much higher probability to the odds that significant tariffs are coming. And then when you just factor in, you know, I think it's, I just looked up the numbers the other day, it's like 15 or 16% of Canada's GDP is exports to the United States. So it's just a huge share of the Canadian economy. And that relationship, I should also mention, is extremely lopsided. For as big as the U.S. economy is, the U.S. economy is actually relatively closed. And what we mean by that is the United States doesn't actually import a lot of stuff as a share of its GDP. So I think one thing to keep in mind, you know, and sort of animates this whole debate is from the US perspective, trade is a much smaller deal than it is for, you know, the rest of the world, and why, you know, US policymakers think they have some sort of leeway to put these tariffs in is because I think, you know, some estimation, it's just not going to have that big of an impact on US consumers, you know, compared to potentially, you know, Canadian consumers.
And do you think that's accurate in your mind? Because, you know, up here, we, you know, continuously hear things like, you know, the premier of Ontario is going to take all the American beer out of the liquor store. And, you know, it's going to be a real, you know, Americans are going to realize that some damage is going to come to the economy down south. Like, do you think that if a trade war actually erupts, A, will it be called a trade war down there, and do Americans actually care, and will it actually impact regular people in a way that's meaningful enough to make change to the policy?
Yeah, as a sort of the argument I laid out, it's making the case that the United States, how much is it really going to feel the effect of, as you say, you know, retaliation, when, you know, the United States just really isn't importing, you know, that much stuff. I think, you know, it sort of might be illustrative if you go back to the sort of Trump's first trade war, that, you know, as he put tariffs on China, you know, China retaliated by, you know, putting tariffs against primarily U.S., you know, agricultural exports. That did start to hurt U.S. farmers, but, you know, the response was, you know, a bailout or, you know, some financial aid for farmers to, you know, sort of offset, you know, that negative impact. So, you know, to some extent, some of those maneuvers might be deployed again to sort of, you know, offset any negative effects that do appear in the U.S. economy, you know, using some fiscal stimulus.
What in your mind, Brendan, is the fallout if the tariffs come for Canada's economy?
It's all a matter, I think, of magnitude in scope. You know, how big are they? You know, how many products does it cover? Because truth be told, in our baseline forecast right now, I think subject to obviously change, but our baseline assumption is that you get about, on average, like a 5% tariff against Canadian goods. So it's modest, but, you know, it's not enough to, you know, do significant damage to the Canadian economy. I'm also, our baseline assumption too is that, at least in our baseline scenario, that Canada does not retaliate. I think the thinking there is that sort of they ultimately assess that it's a better strategy to try to sort of negotiate their way out of it rather than sort of an antagonistic, round of tariffs that, you know, potentially leads to a larger trade war. You know, that's certainly the scenario you want to avoid. So it seems, you know, the likeliest approach they would take is sort of sue for peace and try to reach a deal quickly. So yeah, I mean, our baseline assumption is that the tariffs are going to be small. But in as I talked about before at the beginning, you know, we produce a lot of these like alternative scenarios. And in our most severe downside scenarios, you know, we crank up the knob and, you know, send the tariffs up to, you know, 25% against Canada, something like, you know, 60 to 80% against China. In that scenario, the economy quickly slips into recession with that slowdown in global trade. And, you know, Canada being very sensitive to those sort of global trade winds, there's no way to sort of avoid not getting, you know, sort of sucked up into that downturn.
Did you see, like, is there a point, like a middle ground, like at what percentage do we likely go into a recession? Like at 10% or 15% or
12%?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
25 seems like, yeah, it would be inevitable. Yeah. I wonder if it's more than 5, I mean, what kind of risk are we?
Yeah, so somewhere in between there. I don't know the precise number. Somewhere between 5 and 25.
You know, maybe another question is, for all the talk of 25%, I feel like before that it was 10%. You're talking a baseline of 5%. Does Moody's know something we don't, Brendan?
No, it's just me and, we have a large team of economists. You know, we're just monitoring, you know, the same, you know, news reports and stuff that everyone else is seeing. I think, though, you know, to your point, though, I think where we were a little different, I think you sort of saw, you know, shortly after Trump won the election, we've seen a strong run in equity markets. You know, seen stock markets take off, like, you know, quite strong. We've also seen bond yields increase a lot since he won the election, particularly on the US side. And that's something we probably should talk about a little bit too, because I think that factors in a lot for the forecast, is that, you know, US and Canadian interest rates seem like they're headed in opposite directions at the moment. But if you look at, you know, sort of that initial reaction from financial markets, oh, stocks up, you know, yields up, you know, it suggests that, you know, oh, we're going to get, you know, big tax cuts that are going to boost profitability, but they're all going to be deficit finance, which means, you know, we're seeing interest rates push up. And what you saw in that response was, I think, even Wall Street discounting the probability of tariffs, thinking that, you know, it's mostly threat, you know, like he's not going to go through with it. I think where our forecast has been different than a lot of other folks is we're assigning sort of higher odds to him going through with the tariffs. Where I've seen in some folks' forecasts, you know, they haven't even included him yet.
I seem to remember, I think our last conversation with you, Brendan, we talked about what can be the difference between the Canadian overnight rate and the US rate. And I think it was around 1% that we talked about, if I'm not mistaken, where that's kind of where we would, you know, that seems within the window before, you know, the Canadian dollar really gets clobbered. Was that last time we talked? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, we were talking about that. It's probably worth revisiting because
Because I mean, now it seems like there's going to be quite a departure here in terms of rates potentially between the two countries.
Yeah, and I put out a piece the other day, sort of, you know, start of the year. What are your sort of five keys to the 2025 forecast? And one of the points I keep making is with the United States fiscal situation and a lot of deficit finance tax cuts coming, with the United States putting tariffs into place. If you saw the comments from the US Federal Reserve, it looks like they're going to pause, probably maybe not even a US rate cut again till the, you know, September 2025 or something like that. On the other hand, from Canada's perspective, inflation is well contained. We saw inflation today, it was like 1.8%. Growth is weak, you know, unemployment, you know, still uncomfortably high, you know, ticking higher. You know, Bank of Canada is going to want to keep cutting rates. So it looks like they're going opposite directions. And yeah, our baseline forecast says they're going to keep going opposite directions and let this spread widen. But the implication is, as you say, you know, the Canadian dollar is going to erode. So, you know, just in our baseline forecast, I think we have maybe sort of like 5% more, you know, a little more slippage in the Canadian dollar before it stabilizes. But sort of even in our downside scenarios, that same dilemma, you know, the Bank of Canada is confronted with that same dilemma. You know, what do you do? Do you, you know, offset the weakness of the trade shock and let, you know, the Canadian dollar slide? Or do you try to preserve the value of the Canadian dollar, you know, contain inflation, keep interest rates high? Our view is that, you know, Bank of Canada keeps cutting and provides whatever stimulus they need. And, you know, the whatever happens to the loonie happens to the loonie.
Hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible. This podcast is sponsored by Fenway by Caliber, bringing 209 new homes and 24,000 square feet of retail space to Willoughby Town Center.
And this retail component isn't just adding to the area, Adam. It's enhancing an already thriving community hub where neighbors connect over boutique shopping, great food, and everyday essentials. This is one of the final new construction opportunities to own in the heart of Langley's Willoughby Town Center.
And speaking of Langley, is it me or is Langley all you hear about these days? It's become such a powerhouse with over 7,000 businesses, the population set to double by 2040, and that SkyTrain extension arriving in 2029.
What's incredible about this location is that you're getting the best of everything. Your steps from the Langley Events Center, currently undergoing a massive $149 million expansion. The new Tennis Center and future Willoughby Community Center are right across the street. Plus, you've got the new Smith Athletic Park just down the road.
The location really is unbeatable, with 8 schools within walking distance and just minutes from Highway 1. And what I love is that this is a Caliber project. They're Langley locals with decades of experience who really understand this community. They've partnered with Polyco Group to bring decades of development expertise to Fenway.
With Langley's population set to double and transit connectivity expanding, this is your chance to be part of BC's fastest growing community. Register at fenwayliving.com. That's FENWAY living.com.
Fenway, where small town heart meets urban sophistication.
We are also sponsored by Oakland Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down. If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakland, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakland.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.
I feel like this was maybe even COVID when we talked to you, and like early days of COVID, going back, because I remember, Adam, I think it was, the show was conducted on your balcony with us sitting 6 feet apart. But I remember quite clearly that unemployment was the clear, you know, what was one signal to watch for to get a guide on the real estate market. And that was you had some pretty specifics around that. I'm just wondering what you think happens. I guess it's very difficult days here, but can we talk about a forecast for the real estate market in 2025, assuming your baseline model, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. So thinking about the supply and demand, you know, sides of the market here, on the demand side, we're going to have interest rates coming down a bit. You know, we've seen the market sensitivity to interest rates. As I said before, you know, we're getting decently strong wage growth right now, except that we do anticipate that's going to cool. So on rates and the labor market income, you know, I would consider those positive factors for the real estate market. There is sort of the demographic, you know, sort of pivot next or this year now, 2025. That factors in a little bit, maybe less so than people think. So I'm talking about, you know, it's all the changes in, you know, the number of temporary residents, you know, the change in quotas for permanent residents and whatnot, which, you know, they anticipate will actually generate a contraction in Canada's working age population in 2025. I think the implications for that are mostly in the rental market, and that we'll see a you know, more dramatic slowdown or possible sort of reversal on rents. But as far as sort of owner-occupied housing, you know, probably less of an impact with the changes they're making on immigration and, you know, student visas and things of that sort. You know, on the supply side of the market, you know, we're anticipating, you know, a pretty strong pace of new construction. I mean, those prices are still elevated. Builders can, you know, get a pretty healthy margin at current prices. Are anticipating a little bit of a change in the mix on housing. It seems like the condo one bedroom side of the market is, you know, oversupplied, and we're anticipating a little bit more of a rebound on the single family side, single family construction and apartments, sort of, you know, multiple bedroom apartments, larger apartments. So, you know, putting that all together, you know, what does it mean for the Canadian housing market? It's a real mixed bag of like positive stuff, negative stuff. As I said, you know, all the discussion we just had about, you know, the macro economy certainly weighs on housing too. And adding it all up, I was looking at our house price forecast the other day, and it's kind of really just like wobbling sideways over, you know, the next, you know, no big contraction, no big, you know, appreciation. We've seen a little bit, you know, in the most recent data, we've seen a little bit of a pickup in prices and sales, but I think that's probably just a lot of pent up demand. And now that rates have come in a little bit, you know, you have people sort of snapping and getting into the market. But I don't know if that has a lot of momentum, you know, getting all the way through 2025, particularly with, you know, these trade headwinds starting to hit the economy. Also have to think about, you know, the effect that has on, you know, consumer confidence. People probably going to be feeling a little more pessimistic reading about tariffs in the newspaper all day.
I'm just thinking, Brendan, I don't know if you look at this, but or consider this, but I know in Canadian politics right now, this is obviously a big issue. And at every government level, affordability is a huge issue in Canada. Canadian house prices on average, I think it's close to almost double the cost on average of a U.S. house in terms of dollar amount, obviously in Canadian dollars versus U.S. dollars. Is Canadian real estate overvalued in your mind? Or what do you think are some of the problems with just the cost associated with housing in Canada?
Are you talking about like the construction cost of homes, or just, you know,
no,
sort of the
more so just the cost of like average home prices kind of throughout
like retail cost.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Retail costs in Canada.
and why it seems like at least it's so much more expensive than the US?
This is the ancient question of you know, Canadian real estate. I think I've gotten that question over and over again ever since I started forecasting Canada. It was probably, you know, eight years ago now. I would say, yeah, there are certainly metro markets in Canada that have to be overvalued. And, you know, I guess I'm talking about yours truly included, you know, Vancouver. It's just because, I mean, if you just look at like simple metrics, like, you know, home price to like median family income, and like Vancouver is, you know, off the charts, like relative to other cities. So I think one thing about Canada is that there's some very expensive metro markets that kind of skew the national average and make things look worse if you're comparing, you know, Canada at large to like the US at large. I think some of the Canada statistics might get skewed too, because I think one of the things I was surprised to learn is Canadians are city dwellers, much more so than Americans. Canadians live in major cities. You know, that's going to make housing more expensive with everyone trying to live near like the urban core. And I think, you know, and to a large extent too, I think there's a lot that, you know, both the United States and Canada can do to try to increase the supply of housing in both countries. Because I think, you know, it just simply has been the case that construction has not kept pace with demographics. And Canada's demographics have been so strong recently that there needs to be more home construction to, you know, improve affordability.
Yeah, and the example that people point to in the U.S. seems to be Texas, where they're actually kind of building or building enough housing, and home prices have remained relatively stable.
Yeah, rent prices are falling in Austin right now. There was a huge supply boom. The market got extremely expensive during the pandemic, so we shouldn't look past that. But then builders took that price signal and, you know, building's absolutely taken off. And it's much easier and affordable to build new homes in that part of the country, which is why, yeah, it's, you know, it's sort of markets at work. You know, you see, you know, I think some people, you could get very frustrated, you know, with the real estate market. But you can see, you know, if you bring that supply to market, you know, prices will come down. So that's sort of, then that's a question for Canada. It's, you know, how do you get more homes to market? And, you know, I remember the Liberal Party, you know, had a very ambitious agenda that they laid out to, you know, boost the, you know, number of homes in the country by, you know, a couple hundred thousand over the next few years. I haven't heard any sort of similarly ambitious agenda from CPC yet. So I'm not exactly sure what, I have to be frank, I'm a little naive as to what, you know, their exact plan is to address the affordability issue.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I think about that, because I was thinking, like, in Canada, we've talked, or in Vancouver, I should say, we've talked over the years about just the regulatory challenges of delivering housing. And I know this is a challenge for a lot of regions across the country. And I always kind of wonder how that compares to the U.S. just with the creation of new housing. And perhaps less regulation.
Well, or even thinking about, and I don't know a lot about it, but just thinking about Texas versus California, right?
Sure.
California being similar to Canada in terms of regulatory framework.
Yeah, I mean, there seems to be some movement on this front. You know, there's that whole, you know, NIMBY versus YIMBY debate and stuff like that, which has really taken off online. And it's surprising to see how much housing supply has become a hot topic in recent years. But it makes sense now with how much affordability has deteriorated that, you know, this is obviously like a huge focus. And yeah, you know, people are upset and they're putting pressure on policymakers to, you know, do something about it. And yeah, it seems that, at least from, you know, from the US context and from the Canadian context, it seems to be overregulation has just led to too few homes being built.
Brendan, and maybe switching gears a little bit, I feel like I'm almost, in this case, kind of interested in sort of broader economic trends. In some ways, we often dig deep on the real estate front, but I have a number of questions. One is, like, with your clientele, it strikes me as that Trump was elected with a kind of different coalition than the first time around. A lot of people that are business people, tech people, you know, people that weren't supporting Trump in the first round
My guess is a lot of your clientele, though, are frustrated with the kind of uncertainty of this situation. Is that accurate, or are people really excited? Because it does seem like there's a lot more excitement in the U.S. about the second term, and I'm just trying to square, like, you know, where we're sitting, and it feels like the next 4 years are going to be like a nightmarish of tweets that, you know, changed market direction, you know, and make forecasting very difficult. I guess it's a convoluted way of asking you, what's a take of the business community or the people that, you know, are influential in the U.S. thinking about the second term?
Yeah, I mean, it probably depends on who you talk to. I think, you know, people's assessment is, you know, when you make these policy changes, there's going to be some like winners and losers. You know, maybe I want to make sure I'm with the winners and not with the losers. In banking, I will say that from the people I mostly deal with, sort of on like the risk side, you know, risk control, risk governance side of the bank, these people really like, you know, certainty and predictability. So this volatility is certainly, you know, very much unwelcome. On the other hand, I think they see, you know, some potential benefits with, you know, lower corporate tax rates, less regulation, maybe for, you know, for certain industries. So I think it's, you know, again, I use that phrase like, you know, mixed bag earlier. It's, I think people are cautiously optimistic that he'll do the things he said that are good for my business, he's going to do those. And the things that are bad for my business, he's not going to do that. I think I get the sense there's a lot of like that kind of thinking in like the United States right now. And I'm always like, but you see like the problem there. It's like, what are the chances? Like, you know, it's all going to work out well for you. I think sort of with this risk that, you know, and I will say, you know, it is part of our baseline forecast. What we're assuming is that a lot of the tariffs come into place in 2025, and that starts to have some tangible damage. Markets aren't going to react well. You know, it's going to start to be some, you know, drumbeat of negative news. People aren't going to react well when they hear that, you know, oh, the Federal Reserve's, you know, pausing its interest rates cuts because, you know, inflation's going back up again. As those negative consequences start to manifest themselves, our forecast is that he starts to sort of wind back some of these policies in 2026. And I think that's maybe the thing to remember here is that, you know, no politician's like unbounded, you know, market forces will exert themselves and say, you know, you can't do that, you know, bond markets revolt and things of that sort. So there are constraints on sort of what he's going to do with policy. And in our view, sort of, we anticipate this, you know, sort of maybe overstepping and then winding things back.
Can we talk about bond yields? I know you mentioned those earlier. What is the bond market telling us, maybe in Canada and the US right now?
Yeah, I mean, the oddest thing at the moment, I was looking at the data this morning, the spread between the US 10-year and the Canadian 10-year is the widest I have in, you know, I have like 70 years of recorded data or something like that.
Wow.
So rates have really just, you know, gapped out. As I said before, it's, you know, a lot of investors are putting this bet on the U.S. that says, you know, tariffs will generate, you know, some temporary inflation. The tax cuts that are being proposed are quite massive. I won't go into all the gory details, you know, on the Canadian side. On the U.S. side, though, we're talking about big changes keeping personal income tax rates low, cutting the corporate income tax rate, you know, maybe doing some more. So we're staring down the road at, you know, some large budget deficits over like the next few years. So investors are, you know, betting up the US 10-year. On the other hand, you know, you have in Canada, the Bank of Canada's cutting its overnight rate, which puts some pressure, downward pressure on the 10-year. Canada has a, you know, a budget deficit, but, you know, well smaller than, you know, like what the United States has. So Canada's in a much better fiscal position, you know, than the United States. Other thing that gets tied into these longer term growth rates are growth expectations. And that sort of goes back to the discussion we just had a second ago about, you know, what do you think about the Canadian economy? What's the outlook? You know, we're talking about a below average expectations for, you know, the Canadian economy in the near term. That also puts downward pressure on Canadian bond yields. So other, you know, other things going on, I guess, There's still some changes to come on monetary policy too, because there is quantitative tightening still going on. So that's when, you know, central banks buy assets on sort of the higher end of the yield curve. Canada, or, you know, and they have this, you know, the Bank of Canada has this balance sheet with all these assets on it that they accumulated during the pandemic that they've been trying to, you know, unwind off their balance sheet. They're going to, Canada's going to stop doing that before the US does, which means that there's sort of going to be even more downward. It's going to, the quantitative tightening puts an upward pressure on bond yields. So now that they're going to stop the quantitative tightening, that upward pressure comes off. So, you know, it suggests that, you know, Canadian bond yields could drift even a little bit lower. So yeah, just, you know, you look at the decades of data and you just see this, you know, high level of synchronization between the US and Canadian economy on, you know, and on rates, the labor market, growth, and all these things. And yeah, we're definitely in a unique time right now where it's one of the rare desynchronizations between the Canadian and US economy. It doesn't happen too often.
Adam, do you, I got a couple more questions.
Hopefully it sinks back at some point.
Well, I was just thinking, so what can we talk about what happens if there are, you know, fairly significant retaliatory measures in Canada? Because presumably a trade war is not great for Canadian inflation. Have you modeled out what that potentially looks like? Is there a scenario in which our economy is in recession and prices are going up and interest rates are climbing all at once?
Yeah, I mean, well, that kind of, yeah, when you say, you know, the idea of sort of retaliatory tariffs, you know, the economy's hurting because the US put tariffs on Canada. Do we shoot ourselves in the foot? Do we make things worse by applying these retaliatory tariffs? You know, is it going to make a difference in the US's thinking? I will say, you know, we haven't modeled this exact scenario yet. Because as I've said before, you know, assumption-wise, you know, we're sort of leaning away from Canada going with like a big retaliation because it likely hurts Canada more than, you know, it even hurts like the United States. And I think the other thing we haven't even really talked about with the trade war too, and I want to make sure I make this point, is that it's not just Canada. It is going to be, you know, much broader than that with, you know, China and Mexico. And I think one of the second order effects that, you know, we're really thinking about is, you know, how much does sort of the global trade, global economy slow down? And then, you know, what does that mean for Canada?
Hmm. What the other question I had was, and I know you're a forecaster, not writing policy, but in your mind, like with all that you know about the Canadian economy, what can Canada do to mitigate risk in this situation? Is it literally just shift who we're doing business with over the course of the next, call it decade or however long it takes to shift trade patterns that have been in place for decades? Like what would be your, if you got put on the spot as to what Canada should do in this situation, do you have thoughts?
Yeah, I was coming up with a strategy as you were asking the question here. My honest suggestion would be, yeah, no retaliation because it's sort of needlessly antagonistic. The better way to convince the United States to change course would be probably to utilize like U.S. intermediaries, which I mean like going to major U.S. corporations with major operations in Canada and saying, you know, you need to help us explain to, you know, U.S. policymakers, you know, why this cross-border trade is so vital and that you can't, you know, disrupt it. So yeah, get like the CEO of like Ford Motor Company and GM to like sit in a room and tell, you know, Trump's team how important Canada is. Not, you know, Canada's bureaucrats show up, you know, it's probably what they expect. You know, it's, you know, they're obviously going to, you know, lobby on behalf of Canada, but having sort of those independent, you know, members of the business community saying, you know, don't damage this relationship, don't damage these supply chains. I think that probably would be more effective to avoid the tariffs.
Maybe as a final couple questions here, Brendan, where do you see the Bank of Canada, the overnight rate at by the end of 2025, best guess?
Yeah, the forecast right now is they go back to what we think is like the neutral rate, 2.5%, and they stop there. So we're going to get like a few more cuts at the next meeting. And then they do stop. I mean, for the reasons we talked about before, you know, too much risk to the Canadian dollar, maybe, you know, too much risk of sort of reigniting inflation. You have to go, if they go too much further. But yeah, I think they're 2.5% by the middle of this year, and then they're pausing there.
And as a final question, and I know it's a very difficult moment to answer this question, but at the end of this year, what do you think the headline's going to be for the Canadian economy writ large? And then maybe one for BC or Vancouver.
Oh, that's a good one. Well, I guess I just sort of hinted at it at a little bit earlier, which is, I think it's probably the announcement of some negotiated solution to the tariffs that are coming in 2025. I'll go back to, you know, it's basically the story I was just telling about how some of these policies, you know, a lot of these policies start to hit in 2025. Some of the fallout, you know, starts to materialize. The United States wants to make a deal too. And I think early 2026, maybe a year from now, we're talking about, you know, oh, you know, Trump secures trade deal with Canada.
You know, one thing that strikes me, I can't remember where I heard this, but it was during Trump's first term that somebody made the point that, you know, that he came up in real estate and he sees the world in kind of a zero sum way, because it's in a negotiation in real estate. You know, there's a winner and a loser, essentially.
Yeah.
And just as, you know, just putting it to you, this kind of mercantilist idea, are there actually people, serious people that are, you know, that are agreeing with this right now in the economics world that you're talking to? Like, is his take actually something that I didn't actually think it was a mainstream or even remotely mainstream view of how the economy works anymore, but I'm not an economist.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely went by the wayside, you know, sort of the rise, you know, the thought was, you know, free trade, you know, so it was sort of underpinned all of, you know, the major free trade agreements that happened, you know, through the 80s and 90s and like 2000. I would say that there, you know, like anything, there's a grain of truth to it. There is a legitimate case for tariffs in certain instances. You know, you could say that, I think I saw an article recently making the point that, you know, there are U.S., you know, defense and military equipment that rely on, you know, components from China or something like that. Right. And then like, oh, if you're in a conflict and, you know, your source for the components of your military hardware is your adversary, like that doesn't make any sense. And that certainly puts you at risk. So there's an argument for tariffs that involve, you know, I think what you'd call like domestic resiliency. Another strange fact that always shocked me, I remember hearing when the COVID vaccine first came out, Canada did not have any domestic vaccine production, right, and was totally reliant on, you know, the US sending supply over, which, you know, for the last, whatever, 50 years worked absolutely fine because, you know, we'll send polio vaccines for, you know, no one really ever thought about it until now. Okay, you know, everyone's waiting in line and there's a huge demand for these vaccines. And well, you don't have the production yourself, so you have to wait. So there's an argument to be made that, yeah, you should have, maybe there could be some tariffs in place for what we call like sort of vital domestic industries, and that you need to have like some national security. You need to like make sure that, you know, you always have the ability to produce like certain things. Like I'm reasonable like to that argument, but you know there's thousands of economic articles and papers that will just support the idea of, you know, the gains to trade and, you know, how, you know, we do benefit from trading with one another and taking advantage of countries' relative comparative advantages and strengths and skills and resources and whatnot. So that'd be the kindest argument I can make in benefit of tariffs. Right. But certainly like an across the board, you say like 25% import on all U.S. you know, 25% tariff on all U.S. imports. There's no justification for that.
Well, maybe we'll leave it there, but we do have this segment called the Five Wire Five Lighthearted Questions.
I know, it was my favorite part. I have to get grilled for an hour.
They've slightly changed, but
okay.
Yeah, they're still lighthearted in spirit.
This podcast is brought to you by Spark, the new development sales and marketing platform.
Adam, the stakes have never been higher for launching a condo project, and today's developers and brokerage teams need to leverage the best tools in order to hit their financing thresholds and to sell out their projects.
Spark is an all-in-one sales and marketing software that includes a comprehensive CRM, inventory management, email marketing, and digital contracts. These tools are custom tailored to the pre-sale process to help you capture leads, increase inventory yield, and transact contracts seamlessly.
And here's the best part, Adam. Spark's team is headquartered right here in Yaletown, and they have over 10 years of experience in helping BC-based developers and brokers bring their projects to market.
So if you're selling a new development, you need to check out Spark at spark.re/VREP. That's spark.re/VREP. And remember, Matt, you can't light the pre-sale world on fire without a spark. Question number one, Brendan, is what's a city you visited that more people should know about?
Ooh, that's a good one. I went out to Europe this summer because a friend was getting married, sort of traveling around. And we went to Dijon, France. Only as mostly it was like a joke. Like we were in Switzerland. I had to get to a wedding in France. And we're like, what's halfway in between? We're like, Dijon. We're like, oh, like the mustard? Like the mustard. Let's go check it out. And it was one of the most absolutely like charming places I've ever been. It felt like, you know, you're sort of walking through like a medieval city or something like that. And I feel like, you know, it's like Paris and, you know, stuff gets like all the attention, but I really liked Dijon.
Dijon.
And I was like, I had no, like, I was even like, I was like, literally just like point your finger at a map and you'd be like, well, that's just on our way from A to B. Let's stop there.
The highlight of the trip was the Dijon.
I know. I got like 10 gallons of mustard, of course, when I left.
Fantastic. A book that everyone should read.
Book everyone should read. Well, I'll tell you what I'm reading right now, only because I like, or I'm liking it. The Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury. So a classic. There was like so much, I guess it was, you know, what I was trying to put together like a summer reading list or sort of like a reading list this year. And there was like so much, like it's all discussion of like AI, you know, artificial intelligence, you know, what is it? You know, the dystopian future of like AI or something like that. So it inspired me. I've actually been going back and reading lots of like sci-fi from like the 1950s and 60s. Cause it's like, it's cool to like, you know, we're kind of asking ourselves now, like what's the implication of this new technology? So it's kind of fun to go back to these old like sci-fi books and, you know, they're speculating on what, you know, 2025 is going to look like.
How close?
Martian Chronicles. It kind of, it's kind of like the Twilight Zone reaches, like science fiction.
Huh. Good one.
I'm there for it. What's a strong opinion? That's what they say now, isn't it?
No, it's a here for it. But
oh, here for it. Enough. Okay, there for it. All right. What's a strong opinion you held 5 years ago, Brendan, that has completely changed today?
Strong opinion I had 5 years ago. See, right, I've changed my mind. I don't know if I've really changed my mind about this. I don't know. I'll throw this one out there. We were kind of like playing like a game at work the other day. Like, you know, if you were president for a day, you know, what would like, you know, what's one of your policy, you know, hobby horses or, you know, something. And people at work always know I'm famous for like ranting about we should get rid of the penny. I've always had this like, it's completely worthless. Why are we still using the penny? I don't know why we still keep it. When was the last time you actually made a transaction and used a penny? I would love to hear how long ago it was, but I've actually, to the extent I've maybe changed my mind, I wonder would, you know, what would the public reaction be with the whole sort of like inflation crisis and everything afterwards? I've kind of like pondered about like, do we keep the penny around? Because if we got rid of it, we would have to like admit that it's worthless and we don't, you know.
Yeah.
That inflation's got away from you.
Yeah, that inflation actually like is a problem. Like whatever president sort of accepts the responsibility of like getting rid of the penny has to admit that like the inflation has destroyed its value, that it's sort of, it's like he has to take like the personal hit.
Yeah.
Well, Canada's
away with the, yeah, yeah, I think we've done away with the penny. We have.
Who was that? Was that with Trudeau? I think so.
That's why I think everybody hates him.
Although I'll take all the U.S. I'll take all the U.S. pennies
that's
you
where
have
the
right
bumper
now.
Stickers came on.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you listening to these days? Question number four, music-wise.
Oh, I should pull up my... I think you guys have asked me this question before. Here, I'll give you the direct answer. I got to actually pull up my like Spotify right now. See what I've been adding to recently.
Bring up the year in review.
Yeah, get the rap.
Yeah, well, yeah, here we go. Here we go. Oh, do you know what? You know what, an old favorite of mine? I think one of the best albums ever. This will immediately give away the year I was born. Weezer's The Blue Album.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's just got like, I went back. It's one of the rare albums you can just listen to like front to back because like every song on there is a banger. They're all good. I don't skip a single song when I go through the whole thing.
I feel like
1980 something.
Well, Weezer's, no, I think it came out in.
What?
It's 90.
Oh, no, but you're guessing how old Brendan
is. I was guessing your birthday.
Yeah, 85. 85, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, that's like, yeah. That was a dead giveaway. But yeah, that Weezer in general is a good throwback. Question number five, Matt.
The last question for you, Brendan, and we appreciate your time. If you had to start your career over in a completely different industry, what would you choose?
Oh, good question. There is like two versions of this that I used before where it's like, you know, free from any financial obligations. You know, you're born into aristocracy and like, what am I going to like do with all my time? But if...
That's the next...
You know, to be frank... But there's that scenario where it's like, you know, money's no object. What am I just going to, you know, sort of fill my days with? But, you know, let's go with the more realistic scenario. I'm just resetting the clock, but I can't choose economist.
That's a much better question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you fill your days with
if you were financially independent?
Democracy.
That's the new question. That's a way better question.
Well, you know, it's always funny. In the classic economics models we use, like there's this trade-off between, you know, like consumption and leisure, you know, because I think it's influenced by these like old, you know, aristocratic ideas. It's like, well, once all your needs are taken care of, then you're just going to have all this leisure time on your hands and, you know.
You just have gout.
just watery eyed your state. What would I do? You know, to be frank, I think I was in that state. I was always really good at like math, you know, quantitative stuff, but I knew I didn't want to be a math professor. So I remember being back in, you know, university trying to think of, you know, what do I do with math as to make like a living? Which is why I sort of economics to me ended up being sort of the science of business, which is, you know, why I liked it, and, you know, statistics and all that stuff and whatnot. So probably sticking with something sort of similar in that vein, I think I would have, I know for a while I was thinking about being like a physicist, which I always thought was like really, you know, cool, you know, galaxies, you know, astrophysicists think about, you know, stars and stuff like whatnot. I think I also could see myself doing like some like engineering, maybe, you know, like aerospace engineering or something like that. Always kind of like mechanical stuff. Nice. So yeah, it's a physicist, aerospace engineer, something along those lines.
Yeah. Wow. That's a pretty high level. That's interesting stuff. Yeah. Not for everyone. That's for sure. I could see, I feel like that's terrifying to think of the math involved in that, but yeah. We come from different worlds, Brendan.
Oh, you know, don't you think if you could build a rocket, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Would that be cool? I don't know. I see like the space. I see like the SpaceX launches and stuff like that. Oh, you know, whatever your feelings about Elon Musk, it's pretty cool that they got this like big arm that can, you know, grab a rocket.
Grab
now.
The
like
rocket.
That's, whatever you think about Elon, that's pretty cool what they can do now.
Yeah.
I'd love to be on, you know, that team. It'd be fun stuff.
No kidding. Yeah. Put that way.
Brendan, sure. How can people find out more about what you're up to and, of course, Moody's?
Yeah, go right to economy.com. Someone had some good foresight years ago. That's where we post a lot of our research, analysis, whatnot. You'll see me, you know, a lot of my writing analysis up there.
That's fantastic. Well thanks again. Yeah, that was a great conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah, and let's check in 2 years' time. Or maybe 1 year. Yeah, you asked me what's going to happen in 1 year. Well,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, we might have to, who knows, this year
there might be years worth of stuff to talk about in months. So maybe we'll be in touch sooner than later.
All right. Well, again, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with Brendan Lacerda, Associate Director and Senior Economist at Moody Analytics, and the lead for the Canadian Economic Forecast. So great having him on the show. It's always great, Adam, having somebody with kind of a bird's eye view into how the country that we call home is doing economically.
Thinking about that, it must be odd for Brendan because he's living in Philly.
Yeah.
He's watching Canada in such a, like, you know, his whole day-to-day is basically monitoring the Canadian economy. It was kind of be like being in Vancouver and monitoring the U.S. As your role. It would just be a weird kind of position. And then when he talks about visiting here, he's a little bit like almost gleeful. Like, it's almost like, I feel like it must be a weird situation.
More than
most Canadians about the Canadian economy.
He does. And you know, the other funny thing is, and this goes back to, I think, the first time we ever talked to him, I remember him saying he didn't have any particular interest in Canada before he got the job.
Oh, yeah.
It was not like he spent his life's work getting to this position. It was kind of, I think he got thrown into it, but he's been doing it for years, and he's such an insightful guy. It was great having him back.
I feel like it would have been fun to be a fly on the wall in some of the kind of debates he alluded to when he visited Ottawa, right? It sounded like some people were excited to talk to him about the U.S.
Yeah, well, and you know, I think that was a couple. It feels like everything's in such warp speed right now. A couple of weeks ago, when people thought, "Oh yeah, this is a joke," right? Now we're staring February 1st in the face here, a day away. So we'll see.
Yeah, exactly. But Matt, what else do we got for the day?
What else do we have? We have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is our website where all things real estate related live. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com where you can sign up for things like our weekly mailer, the Live Wire. You get VIP access to pre-sales. You get the back catalog. You get stats, different types of stats. We're sending out sales ratios. If you want to dig into your specific neighborhood or your property type or a certain price point, we got you covered. We also have, of course, private client services.
Yeah, Matt. And if you are not using PCS, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor level information for free. It's available at your fingertips over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Click buy with us. And this is the best way to monitor real estate, especially if you're thinking of buying or selling in the next, call it 18 months, for sure. So sign up and get your free account.
Absolutely. If you want to talk about that or anything else, you can try me at any time, 778-847-2854, or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we got that Kokomo line info at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Well, have a great week, and we're back next week with another great episode.
We might be back with a 25% tariff on. We'll see.
We'll see.
2,000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.